This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 3rd of May 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, broadcasting live from Studio One here in London. I'm Robert Bound. Coming up in the next hour, we'll get the latest on the race for the Élysée Palace from our regular French presidential election contributor, Christine Ocran. Plus, we'll hear some beautiful verse written by the unlikeliest of poets, the Taliban, and on a hospitality theme, our New York bureau chief, Aisha Spears, chatted earlier with Alex Calderwood, one of the founders of Ace Hotels.
So it will be a hotel, 180 rooms, with a 1,600-person seated theater.
That's quite huge.
Very huge, yeah.
And we'll hear a bit about Brazilian guide dogs as the country is finally training their own mutts instead of importing them from other countries. All that plus a song or two and a chat with our design editor, Hugo McDonald, right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. But first, at the top of the hour, the news with Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. The chairman of the US Foreign Relations Committee, the Senator John Kerry, has said after meetings today with Egypt's military rulers that he's convinced they will hand power over to a civilian government as promised amid outrage over the killing of anti-military demonstrators. 11 people were killed in Cairo yesterday when armed men attacked protesters demanding an end to army rule. Kerry said that the military council told him they would hold elections in 20 days' time and would hand over power to civilians by the end of June at the latest.
What I was most encouraged to hear is that this election will take place on the 23rd of May and, if necessary, for a runoff in June on the 16th. There was a determination to make certain that this election happens, and I think that is critical.
Protests have erupted at Aleppo University today, denouncing a recent assault where Syrian security men and students wielded knives and attacked a protest march, killing four and rounding up dozens of demonstrators who were demanding President Bashar al-Assad steps down. In an unusually bloody incident for Syria's second city, video posted on the internet showed young people chanting slogans against the ruling family and being drowned out by gunfire. The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has met with the Chinese Vice President Xi Jinping in Beijing today. Clinton is in China to lead the US team with Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner at the US-China Strategic and Economic Dialogue, aimed at broadening ties between the world's two top economies. But the case of blind Chinese dissident Chen Guangcheng has threatened to overshadow those talks. Yesterday, Chen left the US Embassy in Beijing, where he'd be taken refuge for 6 days after escaping house arrest. He agreed to join his family at a nearby hospital. A US official has said that Chen has yet to make a final decision on whether he wants to leave China with his family. The NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen has held talks with the British Prime Minister David Cameron here in London today. After their meeting, Rasmussen told reporters NATO remains hopeful of reaching an agreement with Russia on missile defence despite opposition from Moscow to the alliance's plans for a missile shield.
In Chicago, NATO will declare what we call an interim capability of the NATO missile defense system. That is the first step in the development of a missile defense that will protect all populations in European NATO countries. But we will continue our dialogue with Russia also after the Chicago meeting.
The nationalisation of Argentina's biggest oil company is expected to sail to final congressional approval today, reflecting broad domestic support for the measure that has rattled foreign investors. President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, a combative career politician who has triggered state control of the economy, and has tightened state control of the economy, unveiled the plan to seize a majority stake in YPF from Spain's Repsol 6 months after her landslide re-election. She controls both houses of Congress and secured strong backing for the expropriation bill in the Senate last week, and members of the lower house look set to give it similar support in a vote later today. And finally, a Harley Davidson motorbike that has been washed out by the tsunami triggered by the earthquake on the 11th of March last year has been found today, 4,000 miles away, on Graham Island in British Columbia in Canada. The bike was found in a container where it had been stored by its owner, Ikuyo Yokoyama. He managed to track it down via the license plate number. The bike is among the first items lost in the tsunami to reach North America. In March, an Alaskan man found a volleyball from Japan. And those really are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan Wheatley. Don't get your Batman cape caught in the door on the way out.
I won't.
It's 5 minutes past 6 p.m. here in London, and you're listening to Midori House live on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 dagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei oo kosa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Proper Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Cross-channel now on Midori House. Yesterday, France saw one of the most aggressive and confrontational TV debates in more than 30 years. In the Intel ill-tempered exchange, Sarkozy called Hollande irresponsible and a liar, while Hollande accused Sarkozy of creating injustice and inequality. The debate was seen by 17.9 million people. For her take on last night's debate and what happened today, we're joined again by our French election commentator, Christine Auron. Welcome to the show, Christine.
Thank you, Rob.
Now, last night was a humdinger. It was like a George Foreman Muhammad Ali fight. Was it billed as such a big fight, or did it come as a surprise to French TV viewers and voters?
No, I think it was a very French fight conducted by two men. They're both 57. It's a generation milked by TV. And so, you know, as opposed to previous debates between older gentlemen, I'm thinking about Giscard Mitterrand or Mitterrand Chirac, you had two very well-trained politicians going at each other's jugular with obvious relish and really hitting as hard as they could, but at the same time never losing their nerves, which of course was part of the trick. Sarkozy wanted to demonstrate that Hollande is wishy-washy, changes his mind, is not up to the job, and so on and so forth. He did not succeed in doing that at all. Hollande was quite presidential and managed to throw back to Sarkozy many of those hits, you know, saying, oh, it's never your fault and you're always escaping from your own balance sheet and so on and so forth. It was, paradoxically, it was a very balanced debate, very technical at times, lots of figures, and not as much emotion as the French like. You know, the French like those sort of rather grandiloquent moments. There were a few of those.
So it was a bit more about checks and balances than some of the headlines are saying in the French and international press today then. Do you think Sarkozy obviously is supposed to be very good on television? He's got a very aggressive style. And was it a surprise for people to see Hollande taking these punches and then giving back as good as he got?
Yes, indeed, because Hollande is not as well known at all. First of all, he has never had a cabinet job. So he's known by those people interested in politics, but he hasn't been around TV debates as much as the outgoing president, obviously. And so, for Sarkozy, it was a difficult job because he had to be aggressive, insistent, but not nasty. Hollande had also a difficult job because it was his first exercise of that intensity and nature, and he had to demonstrate that he knows what he's talking about. And that's why I say it was balanced. It was rough, it was violent, it was fast, but quite balanced between two men with very different characters and styles.
And the presidential debates on French television are set up in quite a gladiatorial way, aren't they? They sit opposite each other. There are two people fielding questions and acting as kind of referees. It's obviously a big grand tradition of French TV, the presidential debate. How did this one rate as a sort of classic in the canon?
Well, the you know, ever since 1974, which was the very first one between Giscard d'Estaing and Mitterrand, the rules haven't changed that much. What has changed, of course, is the style and, again, the pace. And now, you know, everybody has, you know, mobile phones and tweets and God knows what. Uh-huh. So I think this debate is certainly somehow the most verbally brutal and the most technical at the same time, which is why it took a while. You know, it's always very funny to see how commentators react. Whom will they declare the winner? And in fact, I was looking at the wires late last night after the show, and on the whole, people would say, okay, they were different, but they were even in a sense. But my view is that as long as Sarkozy did not manage to kill Hollande politically, Hollande is indeed the winner, because he's been the favorite for second round, you know, for weeks and weeks. And he remains so, and he's still there. And Sarkozy has conducted a formidable campaign, although quite objectionable in the past few days, you know, running after the extreme right. He has caught up a little bit in the polls, at least, but no TV debate has ever changed the outcome of the election. There's no proof ever of a sort of quantitative, you know, a change in numbers of voters after such a debate.
And maybe you could give us a little bit of an idea of how you think the two, the president, the incumbent president, and the nominee prepare for a TV debate like this. I mean, do they both have a phalanx of advisors around them, or do they have kind of one or two trusted people in their corner with the wet towel and the Lucozade?
I guess you lost boxing. To know so much about.
I can't help it. I saw some of that debate last night.
Well, they obviously have you know, a great number of advisors who prepare all sorts of notes on a variety of topics. And it was quite remarkable on both accounts. You know, last night, these guys were able to dig out figures. Of course, they would sometimes disagree on those figures, but in great detail about the budget, about statistics and whatnot. When it comes to going to the studio closer to the moment, they each came with a significant other, let's put it that way, and a small group of advisors. But you know, they're both very well-trained people. They've been in politics forever, and that's their profession. So
that's the raison d'être. And and what were you? How were you watching it last night, Christine? Out of interest, I mean, there must be a lot of, you know, for the last big presidential debate standoff, there must be big parties around town and across the country. Is that a sort of tradition, or do people sort of beetle off home and watch it on their own?
Well, I for one much prefer to watch that at home with a few friends, and also I had to write a piece for The Guardian immediately afterwards. Uh-huh. So, and also no one is really in the mood, in the sort of partying mood. It's not a very joyful campaign. Nobody is very enthusiastic about anything, and not even about the outcome, and not even among, you know, people who are well aware, however close they may be to Hollande, who is the likely winner for next Sunday, they're well aware it is going to be a very, very difficult task. The situation is pretty dire, and it's not going to be fun.
So you feel that even if Hollande is voted in, that it'll be perhaps a modest celebration and a look forward to how you can change deficits and European problems and all the rest of it, rather than a big champagne celebration.
There will be a big champagne celebration because we're in France, and
but it might be more behind more closed doors than normal, maybe.
At Sunday night, you know, there'll be horns and shrieks and whatnot in Paris and other big cities. But starting Monday onwards, the real world and the real crisis will be hitting at the door.
That's called a hangover, isn't it? For whoever wins. Christine, thank you very much for joining us again on Midori House.
Okay, Rob.
Thank you. And Christine will be joining us again tomorrow, as she every day this week, for the last election update before the big vote on Sunday. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back in a moment with a tune.
The Urbanist is the show about the cities we live in. From mayors to street sweepers, from the CBD to the suburbs, this is the show that takes you to the heart of your metropolis. Join me, Andrew Tuck, as we speak to the planners, thinkers and politicians changing the urban world. This week on The Urbanist, we take measure of what ads add to a city, from 3D billboards and flashy signage to posters and buses, bike shares and public toilets. Or is it all just a load of visual clutter?
The amount of content that can be put on there is infinite, and the invitation to engage directly via the screen is as changing as rapidly in outdoor as it is in other channels.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24. Every Saturday at midday in London, join our editors on Monocle 24 for The Review. We take you on a tour of three bookshops in three cities to hear what's flying off the shelves. We listen to some top tracks with a music aficionado from a different region. And we review a stack of our favourite new magazines each week too. That's The Review, the perfect way to start your weekend, here on Monocle 24.
And you're tuned into Midori House live on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound. It's time for a song, and this is somebody that I used to know. Gotcha. That was Somebody That I Used To Know by Gotcha. You're tuned into Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, for over a decade, they've been the avowed enemy of NATO forces fighting in the mountains and valleys of Afghanistan. Yet a new book shines a light on a part of Taliban culture that may surprise many. The book is appropriately called The Poetry of the Taliban, and it's a collection of over 200 poems written by members of the group over the years. Joining us now is one of the editors of the book, Alex Strick van Linschoten. Alex, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Hi.
The poetry of the Taliban is a it's there's some if there's going to be a blank of the Taliban, poetry might not be the blank that we were thinking of. But you can tell us about the genesis of the book and about how important poetry is to that part of the world, and also to the Taliban as a recruiting tool and as a celebration of their history, presumably.
Well, the book started more or less as a hobby, I guess. Myself and my colleague. We were in Kabul, Afghanistan. We were kind of translating documents and working on kind of media monitoring service. And we realized that there was this whole kind of corpus of poems that the Taliban were putting out on their website. And it was intriguing because no one else seemed to be translating them, I guess because they didn't have operational value for NATO. It wasn't giving, you know, attack plans and all of this.
It's not a radio station you could jam, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, still... I was curious, and because again, it wasn't something which was part of our understanding of who the Taliban were and what they were about. So we just started translating them, and we just continued doing this for several years until relatively recently. I mentioned to our publisher that we had, you know, this whole collection of a few hundred poems, and then he said we wanted to publish them because, as you say, it does reveal something new about the group and who they are.
And it sort of does, because I've just a random flick through the book takes me to a poem called Slave, which was written on December the 16th, 2007, so it's really recent, and it starts off, Karzai, you sold the country for a few dollars, and it goes on and on. So these are really current sort of deconstructions of the country and the culture and the government and the leader. These are proper prose poems. These are kind of almost maybe like graffiti or something, presumably. They're very current, aren't they?
Yeah, sure. And I mean, there's all sorts of things contained in them. There's a very kind of satirical dialogue imagined between Bush and Karzai when Bush was leaving his presidency, and Karzai is saying, please don't leave the presidency. And Bush is saying, I hope you won't be sad all alone in Afghanistan.
That needs to be set to music.
You know, what else do we have? We've got a poem written by a woman saying, you know, you men are so useless. Give me your turban. I'm going to go and fight the war for you.
Yeah.
There's poems about love, poems about natural beauty, and of course a lot of things related to the war. In that, you know, the experience of war for ordinary people.
And obviously, I guess the region, Afghanistan itself, has a rich poetic tradition, which this now is a contemporary part of. But but for the Taliban specifically, is poetry used as a recruiting tool, as a critique of the incumbent government? I mean, is that why the Taliban are promoting poetry?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the most effective outreach tools that they have, I guess, because the poems have such strong resonance for people. And it's not just the audience who listen to these poems. It's not just a very kind of small minority, as you might expect. In fact, you know, I have friends who are, you know, government ministers and people involved in the army or whoever, who are on the government side fighting against the Taliban. But when they hear a Taliban poem, they say, well, you know, this really means something for me. This tugs at something in my heart, even though, you know, I stand against these guys, but still, these poems have some kind of meaning for me.
And presumably, I mean, obviously, this comes from an oral tradition. Is it? I mean, how is poetry enjoyed in Afghanistan and certainly in the Taliban parts of the country? Is it still town square material?
Well, it's not distributed. You know, the website is just one place where people can go and download the texts. Yeah. But mainly, it's kind of MP3s which are exchanged via Bluetooth.
So it's done audibly, so it's not
okay. It's not really a written medium at all. And you know, all of this is sung and recited, and there's a kind of brisk trade of these MP3s, which, you know, people exchange them on with Bluetooth on their phones, and the poems and the songs are also used as an accompaniment to the kind of more specifically propaganda videos of whatever, blowing up a NATO truck or something like this.
Yeah.
They use that as a kind of musical background to it.
And are there in the book, as I say, I've opened it at random and found a critique of Karzai. I mean, are there sort of really blatant bits of, politicking in there as well?
Sure. I mean, you can use the word propaganda if you want. It's certainly part of it.
I was thinking of it, but I came with politicking. I knew it was a P.
it's definitely part of it, although it's not as much as you might expect. You would expect kind of war songs from the Taliban to be very strident and so on. There's even kind of self-criticism embedded in there, that one which has the line, "We did all of this to ourselves," which is not really something that you would expect from the movement. So there's a kind of wide variety of styles and registers in the poetry.
And, I mean, presumably your hope is to get these poems out there, but also presumably it shines a light on the subtleties of something that we will probably see as only a bad thing. I mean, presumably the self-doubt that you just talked about is something that we wouldn't expect. The multifarious voices of different genders and people from all over the place. Presumably these are surprise to you as much as you think they will be for the average reader of these poems.
I think so. I think also the poems it's the kind of thing where quite often, you know, you can bring your own attitudes to it. So a lot of people will find what they want to find in the poems. We had that with some of our reviews already. In general, you know, I was very struck reading a book of poems written by British soldiers deployed in Helmand, a kind of collection of contemporary poems as well. And, you know, there's one poem in the British collection with a soldier saying goodbye to his mother before he gets, you know, before he leaves the country to go to Helmand. And then in this collection, we've got a poem by a Talib taking leave of his mother before he goes to fight war against the Brits. You know, in some ways, there's a kind of universalism to it all.
And is there much of a sense of humour in any of those poems? I mean, it sounds like, because some of them sound so direct that they might almost be like writings on a toilet wall, in a good way, you know what I mean? Like, so direct and so critical and quite witty. Is there anything like that in the book?
There is a lot of kind of witty sarcasm and so on in there. Unfortunately, not all of this translates so well, or at least it works a lot better in Pashto.
Yeah,
And you know, Kandahar has a very rich tradition of basically smutty limericks, you know, of which this is all kind of part and parcel of the tradition. So there is that kind of attitude to it, but you know, the broad majority, I guess, is fairly serious.
And I mean, when you to round all this stuff up, did you just take MP3s, listen to the sound, and then transcribe them and then translate them, or did you sort of speak to people and get things in paper off them and ask them why they'd written what they'd written? Did you meet many of the poets that are in this anthology?
No, not really. It's very difficult to kind of put a face to a name for the poems.
Why is that? Is that
well, simply because
backwards and coming forwards, or they are Talibani, and you're not allowed to meet them. Or?
No, that's not so much the problem. I mean, I in the course of my work, I've met lots of Talibs, but it's just the problem is that when they're published online, often they're published without any author. You know, often there's only just one name, so it's difficult to translate. And the people who I have met, you know, I've just met by chance, and they say, oh yeah, I happened to write something which went up there.
You kind of like to meet these people, wouldn't you? It would be interesting to sort of always put a. Everyone always wants to know the background of the author they read or whatever. I guess in this instance as well, it's extra fascinating if they're critical or if they're self-doubting and they're, you know, part of that movement. It must be extra interesting to kind of see what they're like, I suppose.
Yeah, well, it's certainly something I will continue to follow up and keep monitoring while I'm out there.
All right. Well, Alex Strik van Linschoten, sorry about that. Thank you very much for coming in and telling us about the poetry of the Taliban. You're listening to the Midori House News at the bottom of the hour.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Es ist Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 tagat ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei ole kosa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Certainly is. And in the next half hour here on Midori House, I'll be joined with our design editor Hugo MacDonald, get his take on the latest in the Helsinki Guggenheim decision. We'll see what the head of Ace Hotels had to say to our New York bureau chief, Aisha Spears. And we'll learn why one Brazilian got so involved in helping find blind Brazilians their own guide dogs. But first, with all the news, it's Jonathan Wheatley.
Thanks, Rob. The chairman of the US Foreign Relations Committee, the Senator John Kerry, has said after meetings today with Egypt's military rulers that he's convinced they will hand over power to a civilian government as promised amidst outrage over the killing of anti-military demonstrators. 11 people were killed in Cairo yesterday when armed men attacked protesters demanding an end to army rule. Protests have erupted at Aleppo University today, denouncing a recent assault where Syrian security men and students wielding knives attacked a protest march, killing four and rounding up dozens of demonstrators who were demanding President Bashar al-Assad steps down. The US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has met with the Chinese Vice President Xi Jinping in Beijing today. She's in China to lead the US team with Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner at the US-China Strategic and Economic Dialogue aimed at broadening ties between the world's two top economies. The NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen has held talks with the British Prime Minister David Cameron in London today. After their meeting, Rasmussen told reporters that NATO remains hopeful of reaching an agreement with Russia on missile defence. And the nationalisation of Argentina's biggest oil company is expected to sail to final congressional approval today, reflecting broad domestic support for a measure that has rattled foreign investors. President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, a combative career politician who has tightened state control of the economy, unveiled the plan to seize a majority stake in YPF from Spain's Repsol 6 months after her landslide re-election. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan Wheatley. It's time now for a chat with one of Monocle's editors to see what's caught their eye this week. Thursday means D for design, and that means Hugo MacDonald. Today, I talked to him earlier about Helsinki saying no thanks to the Guggenheim. Hugo, I wanted to kick off by asking you about the Guggenheim, about Finland. Whether you think the the Finns are wise or unwise to reject the Guggenheim, whether it's a much big of a deal.
Comes from news yesterday that the Helsinki City Council has said no to the Guggenheim Foundation's plans to plant a Guggenheim on Helsinki's redeveloping harbourfront. And this is a story that we followed over the course of the last sort of 6 months or so. And it is maybe a surprise for many cities and people around the world who would think, you know, who could ever turn down the Guggenheim's offer of coming and building one in your city when you see what's happened to
It's kind of like not wanting to go to the prom with the best girl, right?
Well, it is.
How can the Finns do this? Why do you think the Finns done this?
Well, the Finns have been quite wise, and it's a mixture both of sort of circumstance and Finnish sort of national characteristics of being very modest. So they've sort of treated this Guggenheim delegation with a little bit of suspicion from the start, saying, you know, you're expecting us to pay a huge amount to have one of your museums. Is this something really that we want to foist on our people at a time when arts funding has been cut in Finland and they definitely haven't been hit anything like as hard as some southern European countries in terms of the economic crisis? But, you know, things are still, they've had to tighten their belts a little bit. And so they've turned around yesterday and said no. And it is, I think, also sort of thrown quite sharply into focus when you look at what's happening to the Maxi Museum in Rome.
Yeah.
Which is currently...
Started with fanfare, the Zahdi design building. It's a...
Completely. When it opened, everybody was like, this is the new face of Rome. And it's bringing a whole new generation of contemporary art lovers and sort of dynamic tourists to the city who don't want to walk around the Forum, but want to see a very beautiful piece of contemporary architecture filled with contemporary art. But only 2 years later, it has... Well, it's going to go into administration, or it's likely to be, simply because it costs such a huge amount to keep going. And I visited it in January. I don't know if you've been.
No, I stupidly went on two Mondays when, of course, we all know Italian museums aren't open. Hooray!
So well I'm done, Rob.
But I was on holiday at the time. So.
I went on a Sunday.
Well done, you.
I know, but like, you see, I'm familiar
Diary
with
at the ready.
Monday closing. Yeah. Times in Rome, and it was in a very sorry state even in January.
It's crazy, isn't it? When it's such a how old is that building? Two and a half years. It's to consider that it's in a sort of slight state of disrepair. It's a bit kind of smudgy and dirty around the edges, a bit dusty in the corners. And it's 2.5 year old building, and it's in, you know, it's in one of the most famous art cities in the world, and it's designed by possibly the most famous architects in the world, contemporary architects in the
exactly.
world. It's bananas that it can be like that.
£650,000 debt hole.
Yeah.
And also just very shabby. I mean, for a start, I wasn't a huge fan of the building when it opened, because Zaha's buildings obviously are very curvaceous.
Presumably very difficult to build in Rome. Plonk a contemporary building in Rome is very tough.
Yeah,
Richard
and I
Meyer
think that
did
was
it very well though with his piece in Rome, didn't he? Which is sort of part of an old building, which
exactly,
I think is a really successful way of doing it.
Sort of restored and managing to combine sort of past and present and future. But Zaha built this spectacular gallery with curved walls, which was very difficult to actually put art on. So it was slightly doomed from the get-go in my eyes. But the fact is, at times when there is so little money to go around on art, art funding, you know, you can't sustain such a huge public art gallery. And this, I think, is probably the secret of why the Finns have turned around to the Guggenheim and said no.
It's a sad thing. I think it's a sad thing for Italy, which doesn't have a great contemporary art gallery, for that to be in such a state of disrepair, or, you know, to have this, you know, almost €700,000, £700,000 debt hole in it. But it's interesting in the Finnish side of things, the Guggenheim side of things. The Guggenheim does seem like a sort of great white shark looming off the coast of wealthy nations, doesn't it? Wondering where it can next kind of bite a surfer.
Exactly. It's going to Abu Dhabi, which I think will have more luck in Abu Dhabi than in Helsinki.
And Helsinki, presumably, obviously the Nordic nations, and I mean, maybe it will be pitching up in Oslo next. I mean, presumably it's one of these places where, you know, it's looking for
whatever the emerging economies are, or the once great and now newly great kind of nations are again. It's a funny old thing. I wonder what Peggy would have thought. Probably not been very impressed. The one in Venice is the one in Bilbao is possibly the most famous, but the one in Venice is just amazing because it suits the city and it's the mixture of contemporary and kind of fine art.
Well, it works there in Venice, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And Peggy's buried there.
Yeah.
Isn't she? She's one of the only people to be buried outside of the official cemetery in Venice.
Yeah, exactly.
But you've also recently come back from Abu Dhabi, which is a sort of another case in point of plonking spectacular building projects and sort of cultural institutions in cities that don't really have a history of this. What is the feeling there, if I can turn the interview around and question you a little bit, Rob?
Well, I think everyone in Abu Dhabi is very, very optimistic about it, but sadly they still are optimistic. There's nothing concrete. There's nothing on the ground. There are no cantilevers. There's sort of groundbreaking. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. On Saadiyat Island, Abu Dhabi, the ground has been broken on these projects, but not a lot else. The Louvre is making an announcement later in this year, I think, about when it's actually going to happen, and everyone's sort of throttling back on this thing. I don't know whether it's lack of money. I'm sure it's not necessarily in Abu Dhabi, but maybe there's a more conservative idea of what can really be achieved rather than just this kind of, you know, big spaceship of art landing in the desert or in a city that doesn't necessarily have a history of it, like Helsinki, or in Rome, a city that's obviously famous for its fine art and its amazing, unparalleled art history, but where perhaps, as I say, you know, landing your art spaceship doesn't necessarily go down too well, especially when we've got the money to pay for the rockets.
I know. Well, this is why I sort of wanted to talk about it, because I think it's interesting to see in the next 2 weeks what will happen. First of all, what the Guggenheim Foundation will come back and say to Finn's rejection, and also what happens to the future of the Maxi. I think
you can't pull it down. You can't pull a building like that down that arrived with such fanfare. I mean, maybe it needs better stuff inside it for people to go and see it.
Exactly. Or do you turn it into a performance space or something that actually just requires somebody to sweep the floors and make sure that things are in order rather than constantly having to shuffle around exhibitions on walls that you can't really hang any art on?
Which seems absolutely bananas.
It is bananas.
I wonder if the Italians need an O2 arena. Sounds like a white elephant of Millennium Dome proportions, possibly.
The Maxi nightclub.
Oh, dear. I'll see you in the chill out room.
Indeed. Well, Rob, thank you very much for having me on the show.
Thank you, Hugo. Cheers. That was good old Hugo MacDonald, Monocle's design editor. Next up, Aisha Spears talks hotels, Ace Hotels to be precise.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in. From Barenna jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop. Carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
Subscribe to Monocle and you'll receive 10 hefty issues and our 2 seasonal newspapers delivered anywhere in the world. You'll also receive our special edition canvas tote bag and sometimes even invitations to special events in our key markets. With a variety of subscription options, Monocle is available monthly from £45, and you can also order our special gift package for friends and clients who want to keep an eye on the world. Subscribe today at monocle.com or pop into our shops in Tokyo, Hong Kong, London and New York.
It is Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, as co-founder of Ace Hotels, with properties in Portland, Seattle, Palm Springs and New York, Alex Calderwood is known for spotting up-and-coming neighbourhoods across the US. With new properties underway in Los Angeles and Pittsburgh, Calderwood told our New York bureau chief, Aisha Spears, of the current business trends that have caught his eye.
At the moment, we're very excited. We're actually opening 2 hotels, one of which is in Pittsburgh. I think Pittsburgh, in our opinion, is potentially maybe the sort of Portland, Oregon of the East Coast. You know, clearly it's one of the Rust Belt cities that's been sort of decimated over the years. What's there and sort of rising out of the ashes is, you know, a really great inventory of real estate, You know, at one time that was the wealthiest community, you know, 100 years ago in America. So there's great bones of real estate. It's very inexpensive, and that attracts a lot of, you know, kind of motivated young creative people mixed with the sort of art heritage that's always been there. You know, there's the Mellons and the Fricks and the, you know, Warhol Museum. And most importantly, the technology that's being thrown out of research, high-level research out of Carnegie Mellon is attracting a lot of startup companies and a lot of the big tech companies. So, you know, Google's second largest office globally is actually in Pittsburgh. And a lot of people don't realize that, like, Pittsburgh is the leading research center for robotics. So there's a number of things happening there that are very fascinating to us, and we're very excited about that city. But we're also building a hotel in an Ace Hotel in Los Angeles, which we're super excited about. It's housed in a 1927 Gothic 20s building.
Wow.
The building is a pedigree building for Los Angeles. It's one of the more important historical sites. It was built by Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks and Charlie Chaplin as the showcase for United Artists when they formed United Artists. It's an office building and a theater. So we'll be a hotel, 180 rooms, with a 1,600-person seated theater.
That's quite huge.
Very huge. Yeah, yeah. No, it's a grand, very grand. It was built as a movie palace.
Okay.
And it's appropriate for Ace, you know, and so it's definitely something we'll do something interesting with. But it's so we're going to be somewhat kind of in the theater movie business in a sense, along with the hotel.
And you'll run that as a theater open to the public.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll do a combination of programming through in-house, through our team. You know, I actually, in my former careers, I've been involved in the music concert business, and you know, we're kind of familiar with that world. So it's, and I think our team will adopt it. But we will show movies there again because it was built as a movie palace, and hopefully work with, you know, some of the creative base of people in Los Angeles, because clearly movies is an important thing for them and their industry and so on. But hopefully we'll give it a little bit different spin and maybe celebrate the craft makers, you know, of the film industry.
And I've heard that it's in a very important corridor of Los Angeles.
Yes, actually, it's on Broadway. That's a very good point. Yes, it's on Broadway, which is when you think of downtown Los Angeles, which was the sort of heart of Los Angeles years ago, it's the most beautiful street. It's where you see like the Orpheum Theater and you see building after building of amazing architecture. We actually sit towards the end of Broadway or the beginning, whichever your point of view is. And we're very near the Eastern Building, which is usually considered the most beautiful building downtown. Okay. It's our Art Deco tiled, a glazed tile building. That's a really excellent example of Art Deco architecture. And so our two buildings sit very near each other. And so on. So we're sort of the bookends for this area. So basically 9th and Broadway is the sort of corner.
And when will it open? Very exciting.
It'll open in fall of 2013. Okay. So September. Yeah. So
it's a very nice time of year in Los Angeles.
Yes. Very good time in Los Angeles. And we're ecstatic. We're super excited. So.
And going back to what you were saying about Pittsburgh, it's interesting that part of what's really helped it lift itself above this idea of a post-industrial Rust Belt city, which a lot of American cities are facing, is the invasion of technology in there.
Yes.
And this whole of young culture. And I've visited Buffalo, and I know we all know what's going on in Detroit. In those cities, although they have, say, Buffalo, for example, much closer to Pittsburgh than Detroit, Rust Belt has the same history of being very wealthy, also has the same history of a kind of great artistic tradition.
Yes.
But they don't have that technology sector. Yes. They have a health sector. Do you see technology as really being key to helping develop new cities?
That's a very good question and so on, because actually healthcare is also another big driver for some cities and so on. But I think that there are some cities that are of that size that are better positioned than others. Portland, which I'd mentioned earlier, Portland, Oregon, is another interesting example that's a little bit of an aberration for the size city that it is, in that it has probably a higher, I don't have the empirical data, but it has, I would assume, a higher concentration of a creative class for the size city it is. And that's driven because you have companies like Nike's world headquarters is there, and, you know, Wieden & Kennedy, which is the largest independent ad agency in the world and sort of top of their game in that world. You have Zeba Design. You have, you know, a number of other companies that all feed off the sort of brain trust that's there. And those companies can recruit sort of top-in-class talent from anywhere in the world. Mm. So it brings a kind of an interesting mix of well-paid, very savvy workers, and those in turn really support the kind of creative, independent, you know, kind of cafe culture and restaurant culture and record shops and all that kind of thing. So that's a little bit of an aberration. Like, if you just look at the demographics of the size of the city and the economy and so on, it's So again, I think Pittsburgh has a little bit of that also. Right. And so versus, like you were saying, like Buffalo, I don't know the city well, but it may not have the same drivers, you know.
Let's talk a little bit about business trends. I know you have a good eye for those.
Oh, sure.
And there's a technology story. It is a technology story, really.
Sure.
Looking off the back of that's caught your eye.
Yeah, yeah. We were chatting about this earlier and so on. So there's a really good article in Scientific American in the current issue, and I believe the title is called No Friction. But basically, the concept is this idea of trying to reduce the friction or the number of clicks or the making a commercial transaction as seamless as possible, that, you know, some or all consumers will reward you through that. And so it's definitely an interesting concept that's been swimming in my head over the last couple of weeks since I read this story. And I think one of the better examples is there's actually an app that you can download from Apple and onto your iPhone, and you can walk into any Apple store globally and if you download this app and scan a product code and just walk out. So you don't need to talk to anybody, you don't need to do anything. It's just a completely seamless transaction. And coincidentally, I had read about the story, and that was, again, one of the better examples in the story, and there were others. But like a day or two later, I had walked into the Apple store because I needed an adapter cord. And the employee had actually told me about this app, which I thought was interesting that they were immediately promoting it on the ground. And I think Apple's retail, it's very interesting that they've adopted that, because I think they have some of the better retail employees. Mm. You know, I find that their service is like very knowledgeable, but in a very relaxed manner. And there's always enough employees there, as I found. So it's interesting they're adding that in also, because, you know, for our business, especially in the hotel business, there is, you know, service is a very important part of it. But there are maybe components, we're looking at that maybe you could make more seamless, and someone may, it depends on the context, they may choose either, but it's interesting that they have the choice of both. You know?
Yeah, I find it intriguing that that's something that's caught your eye, because in the hospitality business, surely it's about having a person in exactly the right position with the customer, with the guest.
Yeah, so absolutely.
Where could that be applied in the hotel business?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I've sort of tasked the creative team with that, so we don't have exactly all the answers and so on, but I think I'm an interesting consumer example for this, because I do travel a lot, so I'm definitely thinking about it. But I look at, like, say, iTunes, for example, and so on. Until my assistant had actually set up iTunes on my computer, because I'm sort of ADD and, you know, like, probably would have never got it set up and going on my computer. But now that when it did get set up and so on, now I actually buy a lot of music through it all the time, because it's just so easy. I just go on, one click, buy, done, you know, and I love it. So we're looking at that concept of how we can apply that to hotels. So to answer your question, I think certainly some hotels have adopted this sort of immediate checkout kind of process. I think that's part of it. But I think that people who travel a lot and kind of know what they really need, there might be a way to apply some kind of application where they can immediately, you know, have the car reservation, the maybe whatever lunch or dinner thing they need, laundry, you know, it's like if they kind of know what they need, and you're one of those travelers that just has that knowledge, I think there could be some benefits there.
On not just hotels, but the future of cities and life itself. That was our New York Bureau Chief Aisha Spears talking with Alex Calderwood, co-founder of Ace Hotels. And this is Midori House.
Vous écoutez Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
Detta är Monaco 24.
Esse är Monaco 24.
Das ist Monaco 24.
En Monaco 24 dagat, ja.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
Monaco 24 är jag också.
Tämä on Monaco 24.
The Propojala
version. Monaco
24. This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
You're listening to Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
Brazilian guide dogs now. What else? It's estimated that there are a maximum of 200 guide dogs in Brazil. Even though there's no official statistic about the actual number of dogs, it's clear that there's a need for more animals in a country that has 2.4 million people with visual impairments. A new project in the city of São Paulo called Project Guide Dog is aiming to make guide dogs more accessible. They're beginning to train dogs already within Brazil, a welcome change as most of the animals in the country are imported from places such as the US. On the line now is the president of an institute called Brilliantly, My Eyes Have Four Paws, which is collaborating with this new project. Luis Alberto Machado de Carvalho e Silva has himself been blind since he was 14 years, and he's on the phone now from São Paulo. Luis, welcome.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Now, what's your eyes have four paws? What's what are your eyes called?
Paws de no, I couldn't listen to you.
And what's the name of your guide dog, Luis?
The name of my dog is Y. Just one letter.
So that's easy. And I hear that lots of the guide dogs in Brazil used to be imported. They used to come from the United States, presumably in other countries in the area.
Come from other countries, most of them. I would say that about 90% of the guide dogs in Brazil were trained abroad.
And what happens when you bring a dog over from America and you take him to South America, you take him to Brazil? Do you have to teach the dog Portuguese? I mean, do you have to, presumably, it's different sounds, it's different sights and smells, all the rest of it. But presumably, the language with which you communicate with your dog is very important, right?
Oh, okay. When they come from abroad, they are commanded in the home language, okay? So, many commands we improve in Brazil, and those commands we give in Portuguese. The default commands are always in English.
And is it the guide dog? Presumably, is a very rare sight on the streets of São Paulo. What do blind people do? Do they have to walk with a white stick and be helped? And presumably, they have a very different awareness than maybe people in Europe do because of the scarcity of dogs.
Well, the scarcity of dogs in Brazil are due to the cost. One guide dog to be read takes about $32,000, and they are very expensive. And before the crisis, we were able to get those dogs for free in the United States, right? After the crisis, the institutions, the American institutions, and even the European institutions started being with less resources for training dogs and send them abroad, okay?
Mm.
And since then, we couldn't take those mass dogs in the United States and in Europe. And the SESI, which is the social welfare from the São Paulo industry, decided to create one project to train those dogs over here in Brazil, okay? I'm using my fourth guide dog, and all of them were trained over here.
And Luis, is there a particular Brazilian way of training dogs? Is there something that a Brazilian guide dog needs to know or needs to do that a dog in the United States doesn't? Is there anything special about Brazilian guide dogs?
I usually say that when American guide dog is such as a taxi driver, and one guide dog in Brazil is like a rally racer, you know, a cross-country racer, because the sidewalks over here are very, very, I would say, narrow, and lots of steps on them, and very difficult for a dog to guide one man all around, okay? And because of that, I would say that we are much more strict in training guide dogs than you need in Europe, okay?
So the Brazilian guide dog does have to dance a little. Luis on the phone from São Paulo, thank you very much for telling us, and please give Y a pat from us here at Midori House. We're going to go now to a song. We're going to have a quick blast of God Only Knows, the Beach Boys.
Should ever leave me, though life would still go on, believe me, the world could show nothing to me.
And that is a nice way to end Midori House today. That's all we have time for. Today's show is produced by Danny Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. At 2200 London time, that's in just 3 hours, Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson will be taking the reins of the Monocle Daily. Up next is the news with Jonathan Wheatley, then the next episode of The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck is after that. We'll be back tomorrow again at 1800 hours London time with another edition of Midori House, hosted by Emma Nelson. Thanks for tuning in.